Welcome to the Rad Podcast. Glad to have you here today. Excited, especially after being a week off for Valentine's Day. I hope you all had a great Valentine's for those who chose to celebrate it. Nevertheless, we're back. We're ready to have a great episode. I have the pleasure of sharing this platform with some awesome gentlemen, but each week I get to share it with my guy, and I'll allow him to introduce himself. My name is Larry Jefferson. I'm happy to be here, and glad everybody's here today. Hope you had a great Monday.
Man. My name is Dantrell Smith. I serve as the second half of this great podcast duo and from Memphis, Tennessee, and super excited about today's episode and really just moving forward. If you didn't get a chance to listen to two weeks ago, because we didn't do last week, I'm just really excited about all the topics that we're going to be discussing. And if you didn't know, Larry and I have kind of taken a different approach for this semester, is to really allow our audience to have an opportunity to voice their questions to our panelists. That's one of the big feedbacks that we received at the end, and was people were saying, you know, I had so many questions that I wanted to ask. And so we're going to allow people to really tap in to our guests and do that. But bro, I am like so because, man, of what happened with the Olympics, man. I can't even watch the Olympics anymore, bro. Like, I had to stop watching Olympics. I just got to get on my soapbox real quick, because the whole Sha'Carri Richardson situation, man, that happened, and then they don't allow this other 15-year-old who failed her drug test to perform. Like, I just said I couldn't watch it anymore, man. I was extremely pissed. And I love the Winter Olympics, right? Because I'm huge curling. Like, I know I don't look like it, but man, I love curling. Thank you. I'm glad somebody else is with me, man. But I love curling, man. And so, like, I had to stop watching it, man. I was like, nah, I can't even support it no more, man. I was pissed.
Well, as a former track and field person, I've never watched the Winter Olympics. But I saw it as I scrolled down on the TV screen the other day.
Yeah, man, it's just unfortunate that.
But I'm not shocked, though. I mean, are you? Okay, that means you're not either.
Yeah, I was a little bit. Yeah, believe it or not, I was a little bit, only because for me, I looked at it in the vein of Russia already doesn't have technically a team representing the Olympics.
Right.
So you're already on thin ice, no pun intended. You're already on thin ice when it comes to it. And then, you know, you have this kind of violation, and you get real technical with the policies of this person. You know, this is a protected person because of age and everything else. So that surprised me a little bit, knowing that the Olympic Committee has this discretion, and they were perfectly fine using that discretion against Sha'Carri, you know, in that situation, Sha'Carri Richardson in that situation. So, yeah, it did surprise me a little bit.
I have to agree with you, man. I think maybe not necessarily the way that they spent the narrative, right? Like, I think that was typical. We know that was going to happen, mm-hmm. but the actual act itself, I was a little caught off guard by it, man.
Well, nevertheless, it happened. However, we got two awesome guests here today, and I am delighted to share this platform, as I mentioned earlier, with them. We'll allow them to introduce themselves. Whoever wants to go first.
Dr. Conway.
All right. My name is James Conway. I am a professor at Arkansas State University. I teach United States History 1 and 2, African American History. I'm also the director of African American Studies. We have a minor here at Arkansas State University. I am a son of Hope, Arkansas. I've been all over the Midwest. I've lived in Memphis for several years, Memphis and her suburbs, and lived in Fort Worth for 4 years. And now I am living here in Jonesboro, Arkansas. An hour away from the city of Memphis, just north and west, and happy to make your acquaintance.
Appreciate it.
Well, good afternoon, good evening. I'm Anthony Walker. I am a higher ed practitioner with now almost 20 years of experience. Have worked in academic affairs, student affairs, diversity and equity. I'm also an adjunct faculty member. I teach intro courses in race and ethnic studies. I've also taught graduate level courses in media literacy, as well as educational foundations, and a course in diversity and inclusion in 21st century US over the past years. And similar to Dr. Conway, I am very happy and excited to be here, and thank you all for having me.
Before we get started, Dr. Conway, I got a question for you.
All right.
Is Memphis barbecue better than Texas?
No question.
Stop it.
Told you.
No question.
Told
no question.
You.
Stop it.
No question. And I don't know if you saw this, Dr. Smith, but before I left Memphis, I stopped by one of my favorite spots, Cozy Corner. Which is a small spot. And I'll tell you why I stopped there. I didn't stop there for ribs. I didn't stop there for, you know, smoke links or any of that. I stopped there because they barbecue Cornish hens at that thing.
That's true.
So, yes, you can switch it up like that in the city of Memphis.
I'm going to have to try it myself.
Hey, when you let me know when you're ready to go, bro, I got you.
Mm-hmm. I'll come through as well.
Yeah, we in that thing.
Wait till the Lakers play the Grizzlies or somebody.
Hey, they already played them and lost.
So, Detrell's on you.
All right. So before we dive into the first question, I wanted to let you all know as well that this episode kind of plays on really laying the foundation for other episodes, and no pressure, you guys. Right. But I know they can handle it. But this particular episode, as we talk about the divisive tools, will play on a lot of the other episodes that will follow later on. And so the first question that we got for you, brothers, is just looking at the past 10 years, right? So just the past 10 years in America, what tools do you think have been placed really to divide us as a country, and why?
You know, I thought about this one for a while, right? And, you know, technology is crucial, and there's several things I think we could point to with technology. But believe it or not, I think, and this is supposed to be a unifier, but it's also been used to, you know, really lead to a lot of these other things that are dividing us. And this is going to sound really conservative, but I think cell phones and the ability to record videos of everyday interactions have been used as a tool. It is not the tool, but it has been used as a tool to keep us divided. But because before you can even get to, you know, a lot of the social media posts, you got to have something that's posted first, right? And we got to have something that goes into the ethos to generate all of these different conversations. And I think, you know, what in many ways are good intentions with, you know, post of videos, post of interactions, post of abuse, you know, post of racism, post of sexism, using this tool that we all have in our pockets, that we have readily available, gets into the ethos, gets posted, and then all of a sudden these battles happen in no time, right? And what we start to do is look at these images or videos and we pick sides. True. We're not looking to critically think of any of this stuff, because criticism, a lot of times, if you're going to do it the right way, you cannot have emotion attached. And as human beings, that's hard to do, is separate your critique of something from your own emotions. And so we quickly dive into a discussion on these things. And when we do that, you know, we start to accelerate these conversations. And from there, it goes into all of these different speakers. So I think, you know, for me, you know, my first thing I'll go with is going to be cell phones and that ability to record. What do you think, Dr. Walker?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely to that. As you were talking, you know, I found myself thinking about the idea of ignorance, you know, and how we leverage ignorance to divide, and ignorance just simply being not knowing, combined with the idea of thinking that we know, right? You know, it's like you said, you know, cell phone posts. I was thinking about it, you know, social media for sure, because it allows you as an individual to hide behind this kind of idea of anonymity, right? You can post what you want to post. And even if you're not hiding behind anonymity, you can do it without having to be in front of someone, you know, at that moment and allow them to respond and engage you in a conversation. You can say what you want to say. And then if you choose to disengage or not engage, you can simply, you know, keep it moving. And then the other part, I think, around social media that is important, and I know I'm finding, like, when I talk with students in particular, is they're not aware of, I think, about confirmation bias and how the back end of algorithms work. Mm-hmm. You know, you retweet something, or, you know, you like something, and you do that two or three times, and all of a sudden, you know, you have these things coming in right behind that on all your timelines. So it reinforces, you know, what you've already liked or what you posted. So now you are just going to continue to, you know, you continue to feed that machine if you're not careful. So that's one piece for sure that I think, you know, I think about the role that money plays. You know, you know, a lot of people describe it as dark money, but, you know, the money that we know gets invested in politics and, you know, policy building, lobbying and things like that, but we don't necessarily know where that money comes from. So you can, again, the idea of anonymity, and there's a lot of money that's invested in politics on that back end that, you know, drives legislation. Again, without knowing where that money comes from, we don't know who those influencers are. But what we do know is that, you know, policy drive is driven by a lot of that lobbying. So those are a couple of my thoughts. I mean, I got others, but Dr. Conway, definitely want to let you chime in and drop some more knowledge for us.
Sure. I think that's the thing, too, that when we have these conversations, you know, because we're good Americans, right? We try to avoid this issue of money, right? This tool of a cell phone becomes, you know, about, you know, selling these products. When it comes to social media and you know, these pages where we can go and engage in these conversations, you know, these are tools to make money. We're having these conversations that are dividing us while people are selling our information,
right?
You know, doing this whole time. I just, you know, I think when we really think of it in those kind of ways, that makes the conversation even a little bit more uncomfortable. But you know, this kind of stuff is financially benefiting,
right,
companies when we do this. Therefore, the companies, if they are profit driven, have an incentive to keep this division going. And part of that is, you know, funneling this money into campaigns on both sides.
Yeah.
To keep those main players involved. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Do you think that individuals realize that these tools are in place and that they're engaging and utilizing this, like, technology, money situation, like finances? Do you think that they know that that's in place and it's building this divide?
So I think there's two ways to answer that question. I think one is, Dr. Walker talked about this level of ignorance that we have, right? But I think there's also purposeful ignorance. If we are really trying to confirm our biases, we don't care. We just need someone to confirm the biases that we have. And that's enough for us, because we see that and we say, it's what I thought anyway, right? So let's say we do know that this stuff exists, right? We also have the ability to stay on those platforms and get away from that kind of negativity. True. Oftentimes we're not doing that. I mean, listen, I'm guilty of seeing a post that I like or don't like, and quickly going to the comment section, not to post, but to see the fight that's going on.
Hey, that's facts. That's facts.
And here's the sad thing. Yeah. I know better because I know that these fights, you know, are either confirming or dismissing my own biases.
Your own biases, right.
Because we all have them, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't move away from it enough because it's so tempting to hit that little button to see what people are saying about this. Right. Because before you hit it, you already don't thought, well, I bet I know what they're saying about this. And then you hit the button and you're looking for your own biases to be confirmed.
It's funny that you say that because I just had my students do a discussion board over confirmation biases and what stance they took. How did they move forward from it? And what would make them think that this is the right thing to do? And had they ever dismissed some of the previous biases that they had and said, you know what, I was wrong. And to read some of the discussion boards, I was appalled to see that most of them stuck true to what they originally believed.
Right.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I've done in class in the past is debates. And, you know, and then to Dr. Conway, to your point earlier about, you know, trying to be mindful of the emotion. And, you know, I describe it as not necessarily removing emotion, but being mindful of your emotion, because I don't think we can ever truly take away our emotions. I don't think we can ever truly take away our biases completely. But it's the idea of how do we foster a greater sense of recognizing, you know, what our biases are, and then, you know, either purposely trying to find information to counter that. Just to see, and then and obviously invalid information. I think that's the other piece of it is the that's been used to divide is so much of our opinion these days is built on just information that's completely invalid, and you know there's no trustworthiness to it. But that's irrelevant to the conversation now. You know, I find myself on social media if I see something, I try not to get caught up in the headline. If the headline is really 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 sticks with me, then I'm assuming that that's sensationalized. And then it's been good for my mental health, because what's happened is I'm tired of having to go down these trails of trying to validate and make sure that what I'm reading is coming from a reputable source. Right. So now I just try to disengage from, you know, a lot of those sources to begin with, and just go to places where I know that are more reputable. But what I do with the debates is, you know, we'll choose some topics, and then I tell students, I'm not asking you for your opinion, right? Let's start there. So then you get time to do your research, and you're on one side or the other. I'm not asking you whether you agree or disagree with your argument. What I'm saying is this is the stance you have to take, and now you need to defend that side of the argument. And then the next time, you know, we choose another topic, and they're on the opposite side of it. And once they get past the nervousness of it, generally students say that that's something they really enjoy, because it forces them to listen and think in a way that on our day-to-day actions and behaviors, they don't have to.
Yeah. So Dentrell asked about the past 10 years. Let's think more so around today. What are some of those historical issues that are still impacting us today? I know immediately when I thought about it, I know that the mask wearing thing to me right now has this country super divided. Mm-hmm. But what are some things that have been around historically and still having a major impact on today's society?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Walker, I'm gonna let you go first this time.
Well, I appreciate that, kind sir. You know, when I think about this question, I think about a book I read called Wheels in the Head by Joel Spring. And so when you say what are things that have been around historically and still around today, I think about government and I think about education. Mm-hmm. And what Joel Spring says is the most effective way to control a population is through government and through education in the U.S., because at least in theory, those are the two entities that every person has to engage in some capacity. So if you control policy and you control curriculum, you control the narrative and you control the power, right? So those two pieces, and you just see how that just kind of starts to branch off into everything, whether it's assessment, whether it's the curriculum that we teach, we're not allowed to teach, whether it is, you know, the laws that we put in place and how those are very, at least historically, you know, we know now, systematically designed to disenfranchise, you know, particular communities while benefiting other communities. And I think that those two, for me, are a piece of it because, they impact every single person, whether you are actively engaged or you're passively engaged in them. And then I think we're seeing that play out today with the intersection with politics, you know, critical race theory, and how we're able to generate a problem that doesn't exist, right? Like we have people that are running, you know, entire campaigns on removing something out of a curriculum that wasn't ever in the curriculum, you know, but we know that back to the very first part of the, you know, your very first question about things that have been used to divide. We know that those words are going to trigger people. We know that certain words in there are going to lead people to think with or to be moved by emotions first, and they're not going to go and, you know, seek out information to see if, well, is this really being taught in school? No, they're going to hear certain words, and they're going to respond. So I think you're seeing a lot of that play out, you know, and we'll continue to see that play out. You know, we're just kind of in the next rotation of systemic responses to, you know, attempts and efforts to continue to make progress. So, you know, you could almost see it coming 2020, right? Ooh. Once Black Lives Matter started to get a lot of momentum, Me Too starts to get a lot of momentum, you know, the system is going to respond. And how do you know that? Yeah. History shows us that they're going to respond.
Yeah, to Dr. Walker's point, you know, one of the things that I used to say about progress, and this is something I learned living in the city of Memphis, right? Progress is often two steps forward, one step back. Hmm. Right? If you keep that mode going, you'll eventually get there. But it's that step back, you know, and the things that are involved in that step backwards that really hits you, right? Dr. Walker talked about critical race theory. Right. Let's be honest, you know, critical race theory, you know, is problematic, you know, because it discusses not just race, but it's, you know, for a lot of these, you know, opponents of it, they look at it as another word for Black progress or discussing Black issues. Mm-hmm. And it's these type of things that really, you know, really fuel, you know, a lot of the policies, a lot of the division that we get. And it's unfortunate because I think what we've seen over history are these attempts to, you know, discuss, you know, a lot of these issues, and every term that we come up with is one of these terms that is quickly shot down, and a lot of times with policy. Whether that be diversity, that could be multicultural, that can be equity, that could be inclusion, that can be any of these terms. And now critical race theory, something that's been around since at least the 1970s, if not sooner than that, but looked at in this academic lens, at the collegiate level, in particular in graduate school and definitely in law school, to the point that most people who do race studies don't even fully understand the whole concept of critical race theory, but we're all being baited into this box. And it's really just the term itself. The term itself is being broadly used to cover anything dealing with race, as Black kids, as brown kids. You know, I did a thing on Japanese internment, and somebody told me that was critical race theory.
Really?
You know, well, because critical race, if you look at, and Dr. Walker, you can help me on this, and y'all can too, the way these policies are being written, the policies, when they are written, are not saying anything about critical race theory.
No.
You know, but what they are saying is, you know, basically don't teach these type of things. And the reason why this is important for many policymakers is it involves emotions. It is to keep people from feelings being hurt. It has nothing to do with historical facts. It has everything to do with present day emotions.
Yeah, you know, and the other part about the policy, I think that is important to keep in mind is that, because I've heard these arguments, you know, over the years, long before, you know, our current, you know, environment and culture as well. But it's the idea of it's not always necessarily how the policy is written. It's how the policy is implemented, right? So you take the idea, like up in New York, and it was found unconstitutional because of how it was implemented. But you take the idea around stop and frisk. The way the law is written may not be problematic to a lot of people because it doesn't say we're going to stop people in certain communities that look a certain way, that are dressed a certain way with certain you know, hairstyles, and frisk them. The policy says stop and frisk, you know, very generic language. But what we know from the implementation, from the data and the research, is certain communities and certain people within certain communities are targeted. So there's the way the policy is written, but that's not the end of it, right? Like, the policy is the tool. And I think where our conversations get, you know, hijacked sometimes, but definitely become, you know, shortfalls in the conversation, is we got to figure out, to Dr. Conway's point about the emotion, how does that policy then get manipulated or translated into implementation, which has everything to do with our emotions as much as anything.
Yeah, and this kind of stuff, you know, does not, the policies and the way they are written, right, it benefits one side over the other. Now, when we're talking about emotions, right, if we're talking about that kind of divide in the nation, even the people who are suppressed by a lot of these policies are not the ones trying to divide themselves from the people who are benefiting from these policies. A discussion about policy should not be a divider. Yet the people who are running, running the country, running the states, running the cities, running the counties, are using these discussions about policy that is in place that we can all read for ourselves as a way to divide. So me showing you a policy is divisive. Me telling you to know your rights, or a person teaching know your rights workshops when it comes to being stopped and pulled over by the police, should be celebrated in a country that loves the laws that it was founded on.
Right.
But for some reason, that is a tool of division too, right? So we're not going to get any, knowledge is not getting us anywhere. Knowledge is dividing us, because on one side we're learning that knowledge, and we have an emotional response, and we try to have time to, you know, reckon with what we just learned. But on the other side, people are mad that you're actually learning this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so it's this stuff is just dividing us. And as those of us, all of us who work in education, we're literally left in the middle of this whole thing.
Oh, man. Trying to swim, man.
Right. Because we have a duty, one, to tell the truth. But two, not to alienate people as well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, you try doing that every day as a in Ventrell in our role.
No, brother, y'all can have it. Y'all got it.
Right.
Man, y'all hit the nail on the head on a lot of different topics. And before we dive into the next question, I want to open it up to the floor to some of our guests that are here and give you all the opportunity to come on. You can unmute yourself, ask your question, or you can type it in the chat if you can. But I saw we had a hand up, and I don't know if that was a mistake or not, but please, by all means, let's continue this discussion. Or not.
Let's see.
Looks like it's Terrence.
Hello?
What's going on, Hello? X?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, really, you know, other than, you know, control of money, what do you think just the basis of it is? I mean, I really don't think that most people wake up wanting to engage in a culture war. Most people, they just want to go about their day, you know, do their things, go home, go to sleep. When I look at it, I mean, it just keeps coming back to the money for me. You know, certain companies benefit from exploitation, and by getting people riled up, that seems like a good way of preventing any kind of meaningful conversation.
So I'm sorry, who are we speaking with?
I think it was Daniel.
Was it Daniel?
Yeah, it was Daniel.
Daniel, thank you for your question. I honestly think, you know, as a historian, that we have a history that we've never reckoned with, especially in the South. And because we have delayed that reckoning, when we wake up, no matter what race or ethnicity we are, conscious of that history that has not been reckoned with. And with that consciousness in the back of our minds, if one little thing triggers us, confirms our bias, no matter, again, what race, ethnicity, and sex that we are, we're ready for this culture war at any moment.
Mm.
And that's a very unfortunate thing. Wow. But that's where we are. And that's where we're going to stay until we have a true reckoning with history.
So what does that look like, though, Dr. Conway?
The reckoning with history?
Yeah, like what does that look like? People coming together on a platform or leadership coming, addressing this? How does that look?
Now, is Dr. Walker still on? Because I don't want to talk about all of the time.
No, I'm here. You're good, though. Look, I'm learning. Look, I'm sitting back learning.
He's taking in that knowledge.
That's right.
See, man, you know, I had some coffee. That's the only reason why I'm still talking. Right. But you know, and again, I think Daniel brings up a good point. But, you know, I think first and foremost, Mr. Jefferson, we got to acknowledge that race is socially constructed. That doesn't mean we cannot be proud of who we are and what region of the country we're from and our ancestral background, no matter what it is. But first and foremost, we got to understand that race is a social construction. The way we think about race in the United States, which was a, you know, if that started off, what becomes the United States starts off as British colonies. And yet we have these other regions, but what dominates, what permeates America today is the colonies and its expansion from a British perspective. The way we think about race may be completely different from the way someone in South America, someone in places where they only deal with racism in different kingdoms and different tribes. We have to acknowledge this social construction and what that social construction has done to divide us. I think that's first and foremost. Once we deal with that issue, I think we can move forward with learning more about the past. But we have to be, this is going to be controversial. Yes, but right. I think we have to get to a point, first, that we acknowledge, two, that we have this reckoning, and three, we have a period of forgiveness. It's what they called in South America, truth and reconciliation. Mm. We have not, you know, after apartheid, we have not been able to get to that point. Even if you look at apartheid South Africa, who had its own truth and reconciliation, right? They're still dealing with the legacy of apartheid. But if we're not willing to at least deal with it, we're never going to get to a point where our children and our grandchildren don't have to deal with this mess.
Yeah, I think that's important. You know, it's like we want people to heal, but we haven't acknowledged that they're hurt, you know, and then we haven't recognized what our role is, you know, as a country in that. And I think that, you know, to the question also that Daniel raised, I think that it's, to me, the beauty of that question also is it creates an opportunity to talk about what this looks like in layers, right? Because ultimately what happens when you start to peel back the layers of the onion, the system that we know that we all have to wake up and navigate on a day-to-day basis really only ultimately benefits a very, very small group of individuals. But what we do is you know, it's manipulated, you know, whether it's through and I think that ultimately comes down to money and power, right? Because to me, those are inherently connected. But what we do is we find ways to create almost like a hierarchy of power where some people have a little more access to money than other people. So then there's that layer, you know, and then we take it back another layer, and we use these different social attributes to create these different layers. But I do ultimately think that, like you said, most people, I don't think, wake up every day with, you know, with these certain things on their mind that we're seeing playing out. But I also think that, and we're seeing it play out, is that it doesn't take much to trigger, you know, some of those implicit biases that, you know, maybe 10 years ago, they weren't as easily triggered, because we didn't have social media platforms and, you know, cell phones and all those things where we can instantly have something that's going to, and we only get a snippet of the information. Yep. And we get that snippet and we run with it. So right. I do ultimately think it's power and money at the end of the day, but it's how those two pieces are used to create that divisiveness. And I think the beauty of it, and I say, know that I don't think this is a pretty thing, right? But I think the beauty of the way this system is constructed is that we wake up every day with unintentionally often reinforcing a system that we want to try to dismantle, right? Like I wake up every day knowing that these things exist and these systems exist, and there are times throughout the day where I can almost guarantee people could point and say, you just reinforce the system unintentionally, you know, or by not saying something or by saying something. And I think that's the complexity of it, but it's also the simplicity of it at the same time. Like we know it, but we don't know how to address it at times because it is so messy and complicated.
And to Dr. Walker's point, we gotta want to do it, right? I mean, even on the days, you know, where I'm most mad, I realize how stupid a lot of this stuff is, because I know that it's to benefit people. Man, listen, I know, and I'll say this way, because I know I got family back home who are probably listening too, but I'll say it this way. So I grew up around, you know, some street people, right?
There you go.
And this is what, you know, this one guy who was really influential in my life used to say. He thrived off community conflict. Thrived off of it. And one of the things that he used to instill in me was that money is not a consequence to the people who have it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no consequence. What is money to get these two people, you know, to be at each other's throat to you if you have the money to give? Right? And so we got to wake up knowing this. Knowing that there, one, that there's systems in place,
right?
Knowing that there's money, you know, way too much money for those few people that have it, and three, for the have-nots, we got to know the manipulation that's having to us every single day, you know, when it comes to all of this stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And last, to me, it's important for my kids and my grandkids to grow up in a world where they don't have to deal with this stuff. I just don't have the confidence that world is going to exist.
Nope.
Anyway, great, go ahead.
Great question, Daniel. Appreciate you, bro. Yes. Anybody else?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was curious if you all could talk about classism. I feel like classism is a very divisive tool in this country. That goes outside of race, you know.
Good question, Terrence.
Hey, what's going on, X? So I'll say this about classism. It really is one of those things that you get communities that divide themselves within communities. Okay. And those same people within those communities will start a culture war within its own community. Hmm. And that's very unfortunate. We don't get the unity that's needed, because if we are going to, you know, get past all of this stuff, you're going to have need unity across the board, but you're going to need unity within as well. And you're right. You know, when we get to the point where we are only concerned about our own money, when we are comfortable seeing people who are homeless because homes are unaffordable, right. Or, you know, people are not able to pay, you know, exorbitant taxes like what we see in states like Texas. But when we get to a point where we live in that kind of comfortable, you're right, we're perpetuating the problem as well, right? But for those of us who come from a have-not situation and are trying to get to this capitalist middle-class mindset, right, it's hard for us to see ourselves as the problem because we've been ingrained with trying to get to this level that only gets you to a state where you're even more paranoid.
Right.
To be middle class is to be paranoid of everybody. So that's my take. What do you think, Dr. Walker?
Well, I agree. I think that, you know, when I think about, you know, conversation around class and classism, for me, two things. One is, or I guess three things. One is, it's an opportunity to draw on intersections, right? Because I think what we often do is sometimes we don't feel comfortable saying the word race or racism, so we use classism instead, when those are completely separate. But at the same time, as you look at, you know, how we operate as a system, they are inherently connected. So I don't think that, you know, there are times where you should separate them for a very targeted conversation. But at the same time, in general, I don't think we should separate those two topics because of the impacts. The other piece of it is I think about this idea around this myth of meritocracy, and how that combined with this perception of capitalism breeds this idea of individuality, right? When the reality of it is, none of us have made our money on our own. You know, like I remember reading a quote that said, there is no such thing as a self-made millionaire. Because if you have products, right, like you rely on truck drivers, interstates, that means you rely on construction. That means you rely on all the IT people that do the tolls. So I think if we figure out a way to have a more collective mindset around, where does my money come from? You know, it's not just me coming to work, right? Like, I'm not going to be successful if I don't have colleagues. And then how do we then reinvest that money in a more collective mindset to try to empower communities versus exploit communities? Because we want to hold on to ours because we've worked hard for it, right? And the reality of it is, there's a lot of people out there that are working a lot harder who don't have, because they don't have access, they don't have the privilege, they don't have, you know, the network. So I think it's another great question. I don't think it's something that we talk about enough. But I also think that it's something that when we do talk about, we've got to be willing to dig down below the surface and have that real conversation.
Right.
I agree.
Yeah, great question, Terrence. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
I will say this, because I know we got some students on here. What I always used to remind my students when I was in Fort Worth is they, you know, we would talk about work and class and all of these different things, and they would talk about who works hard. And I would say, well, do you think I work hard? They would say, yeah. And I would say, the person who's out there cleaning those bathrooms right now work a whole lot harder than me and get paid a whole lot less.
Mm-hmm. Facts.
Facts.
Especially with COVID. They are keeping us safe and clean all day long and probably aren't getting any extra money to do all of these different things,
right?
So when we look at class, as to Dr. Walker's point, when we look at who's doing what work, what kind of work, and you know, when we talk about how class and race too often go together, those of us who have lived in places like Memphis know that this is the case. You know, when we look at those different things, you know, we get back to, you know, these discussions that involve race and how we keep being divided, you know, along these racial lines. Fort Worth is a great example of that, in my opinion, too.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from our audience? I think
it's we really do welcome your questions. I mean,
yeah. Going once, going twice. I mean, Larry and I got questions for days, but
I would ask, if it's all right, just real quick for Terrence and Daniel who asked questions. Did we respond to your question, you know, appropriately? You know what I mean? Like, did we kind of get to the points that you were hoping we'd get to, or?
Most definitely. I mean, we could talk about class for hours, right. But no, I
Right. Yeah, this is Daniel. For me, I look at the world and I'm pretty confused. And, you know, touching on classism, you know, I came from a very blue collar rural family. And I ended up, you know, my mom's side of the family, there was, you know, the anti-racism. My grandma was a union postal worker and, you know, kind of came to it through that. My dad's side of the family was from Central Kentucky, extremely racist. Ooh. And so I've actually, you know, as I've kind of had to let go of most of the people that I grew up with, and I find that other certain classes of people may not take to me as, you know, as welcoming as I would think. And that's where, you know, I started learning about class. But yeah, it's been a great, you know, great podcast.
And Daniel, I was about to give a high five because I'm from Kentucky as well. Until you threw that line, I was like, I'm gonna go ahead and stay low for a second on that.
but you know, Kentucky
as well.
I'll say
Daniel,
this.
Daniel, that's my boy, man. We grew up together when I used to live out in Louisville, man. So we reconnected, man, and been talking a lot about classism, man, unconscious bias, all that stuff, man. So he's trying to grow with it, man. So it's been cool.
Yeah, and I'll say this to that point, right? You know, I grew up poor and have, you know, made it to what most people would consider the middle class. But when I, you know, my foundation is still, you know, with people in struggle. Absolutely. So, you know, for me, you know, I'm more than likely would have a better relationship with someone like Daniel than someone who's, you know, African-American and you know, a top engineer or accountant at Lockheed Martin or something.
Right.
That's just the truth because, you know, unless they also came from that class, you know, and you know, my wife is a doctor, but I can promise you there's a lot of people that she can't stand that she work with. Right. But it goes to this point about what we do have in common and, you know, the things that where we can find common ground. How can we be united? I'm always looking for those different ways to be united with different people. I'm always looking for commonality. Right. But here's the issue with all of that, Daniel and Terrence, as long as we look for commonality with individuals and not with a collective. Right. We're never going to get past any of this because I could be, you know, great friends with Dr. Walker all day long. But if I see Daniel and, you know, I'm looking at him sideways and I don't know anything about him, we're going to stay divided. Yeah. As a nation, as a people, as folks in Fort Worth, as people in Arkansas, we're not going to get past. And that it's becomes that part of this issue, too.
It's funny that you say that because one of my students asked me today, or last week, actually, he said, when we walk the halls, you speak to everybody. I said, because at any time, you never know what that person is going through. And I don't want them to look at me and say, oh, he's higher than this and higher than that. And as soon as I said that, I walked outside, walked across the street to get me something to eat. I'm walking back. Lady is walking in front of me. She clenches her purse. And I'm like, I got a handful of food. Man, it's just amazing how some people can look at you one way. As my student, like, wow, people are so receptive to you. You greet people with a smile, they smile back, and then you walk out, and 3 minutes later, somebody else looks at you in a totally different window. So it's just amazing.
Right.
And it happens all the time, right? Like, it's, I mean, we could sit up here and go back and forth for hours sharing stories about, you know, stuff that happened last week, yesterday. I mean, it happens on a daily basis, and it's truly unfortunate. So, before we close this out, man, I want to give an opportunity because we always want to make sure that our listeners have some tools to really walk away from the conversation with, right? And so in terms of Dr. Walker, Dr. Conway, where can we start, right? So individuals are listening. like, what kind of advice would you give these individuals to be like, hey, you can start here? Or like, where do I begin? Because it the system is frustrating, right? And it's overwhelming at times. But how do we really move the needle forward? And where would you advise people to start?
Other than within.
Right. No, I think, so for me, I think that if you're a reader, and I've been very fortunate to say I've become a reader as I've gotten older. I wasn't when I was younger. But I think make some intentional efforts to decolonize your bookshelf, right? You know, be very intentional in, so let's say you have a topic of interest. You know, who are authors that you know are going to have opposing views, or who are authors from different cultural backgrounds and identities and you know, social attributes that you can read and on the same topic and you see their different perspectives, right? You know, in the research and things. So I think that's one. These types of conversations, I think that figuring out what this looks like beyond just these settings, you know, obviously in safe settings, you don't want to, you know, have harm caused, but, you know, have these conversations with, you know, with your peers or, you know, continuing to engage with, you know, Dr. Smith, Mr. Jefferson and us on it. But I do think that ultimately, you know, Mr. Jefferson, you said from within, for me, that's where it all starts, right? You know, the core of my research and things is on identity from a lens of socialization. So one of the things we've been talking about, and it's had a lot of impact in a very short amount of time, I can see through the reflections with this semester in particular, is think about the different cultural lenses that we see the world through in those social identities. So for example, you know, when we talk about race, what lens am I seeing that through? So for me, I'm seeing it through a lens of whiteness. And then also, what is my prescription? Right. So it's not just that, it's not just my lens, it's how am I seeing it? It's my social lens, but then it's the prescription that comes with those glasses. And just do those for your different, you know, identities, right? So what have I been taught about sexuality? What have I been taught about religion, language, all these different things, and collectively start to put all these different intersections of my identity together to see where my gaps are in some of my learning, to see where my biases are. And then you make that intentional effort to try to, you know, to do some outreach and challenge yourself to continue to grow. But to me, it does. It starts with that social lens and, again, your prescription.
I like that, man.
Ooh, man.
I can't take credit for it. It's in a book.
So with critical race theory.
Right. Oh, and then one other thing, I'm sorry. And you all were talking earlier, Mr. Jefferson, you said something earlier that made me think about it. Figure out how to challenge and figure out how to try to disrupt the good, bad binary. Yeah. Right? Like we have, like, I think our system relies on us thinking about things from you're this or you're this. And the reality of it is you're this at times, you're this at times, but it's not about being good or bad. It's about, you know, who are we as individuals? And then focus on the impact versus the intent. There are so many well-intentioned individuals walking this earth that are having tremendous negative impacts on people and communities. And then we just hide behind this frame of and this lens of, but that I didn't intend to do that. So So think about impact that we're having versus intent.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I always go back to this. I believe it's Socrates who has this quote, an unexamined life is not worth living. Mm-hmm. I think we have to constantly analyze ourselves. We have to have self-analysts, because if we're not analyzing who we are, right, then we let other people determine that for us. And as much as we let people make these determinations through these algorithms, through everything else, then we never truly find out who we are. And that's what we go into these culture wars, these social media posts. We go into all of these different avenues with that kind of mindset of letting other people shape us. You know, one of the most powerful people in your life is the people who teach you. You know, whether that be your parents, your professors, your teachers, you know, whoever that is, you know, you got to also question what they tell you, but you got to be able to question those things in a constructive way, right? You question that stuff with knowledge, not with your opinion.
Right.
And I think, you know, we have to get to that point where we start to, one, analyze ourselves, and two, question the world that's around us, and especially the people that are teaching us. That doesn't mean you agree or disagree, but you at least need to know what they're telling you is facts. I'm trying to say it because I know we're beating a dead horse, but you got to read. You have to.
Got to, man.
If you're someone who's liberal, watching Fox News is not your real version of conservatism.
I said it again.
I'm not being funny because I know there's a lot of people, you know, that's what they, you know, subscribe to, right? Is, well, I get, you know, the opposite information from something like Fox. Then no, that's not. You don't even know about National Review and some of these other historical publications that's been out there giving us real conservative information. And by getting that kind of information, you know, where those policies are, because that's what they're going to talk about. They're not engaged in culture wars. And same thing from the other side. If you're a conservative, stop watching MSNBC. That's not the cup of tea for you. There are plenty of magazines that are historical that you can look at and see what the policy stuff is. Once you know that information on both sides, you can make an intelligent decision on what you think is best for you and what the right way is. But the worst thing you can do, though, is avoid all of this stuff.
Thanks.
You know, to say dismissive comments like, everybody is racist, everybody is sexist, they had slavery everywhere. Those are dismissive statements. And usually they're statements that you make or we make because we don't have any kind of either answers or knowledge on these topics that are being discussed.
Yeah. Well spoken, sir.
Let me say one more, Dr. Walker. And finally, we got to go. I think this is me being authentic. We have to start from a standpoint of love. Mm-hmm. I think it's easy for us to start from a standpoint of hatred, right? Those of us that are in relationships or marriages know it's easy to go and get mad and fight with your significant other. It's harder to sit down and work things out. But being in these relationships, we have to, we have to be human enough, you know, to come at things from that standpoint. If we start from a standpoint of love instead of a standpoint of hatred or ready to fight as soon as we see something, I think we're a better world doing that too.
Yeah. I'm sure a lot of people need to hear that point right there, man.
Yeah, and then I know we're right at time. The last two things, and you know, Dr. Conway, I think you said it much better than me. You know, you said start from point of love. You know, I tell people often, like, I try to start from a point of do no harm. You know, Killer Mike said, you know, think about who our decisions or who our policies are going to impact first and worst, and then you work your way backwards from there. But then another tool, I think that I know our data shows that is definitely not utilized enough, and it connects with reading and being engaged, is voting. You know, our voting, you know, is a powerful tool. We got early voting and things going on right now, I know around here, but you know, but don't just go in and vote, right? Like, read, know where you stand on, you know, the topics that are the most interest of you, and do your best to try to make an informed decision when you go in to vote.
Yeah, don't be a straight ticket voter. Actually investigate the
people. Say it again, man.
Yep. Yeah, investigate the people that you're actually voting for. It matters.
Well, shoot, I learned something today. I'm sure everybody else on here did too.
Always, man.
That reference to Killer Mike, that was a great interview that he had. I think it was at the Atlanta conference.
I think so.
Yeah, for those who haven't watched it, check it out. He dropped some great knowledge. But before we get out of here, Dentrell likes to give us his blessing with a great quote. So what you got for us today, sir?
All right, man. So it says, when we as a people overcome the need to want to always be right and the need to defend that belief or opinion, recognizing that we must compromise and leave room for those of differing beliefs and or opinions. Then we may exist in a world where every controversy doesn't turn into a national debate. We must be tolerant and open. When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. Jimi Hendrix.
Okay, now.
Boom. That was great.
That's awesome. We
appreciate you fellas again. Thank you, audience, for being here. Thank you, Daniel and X for your questions. We looking forward to next week. We have some awesome guests on. But until then, for those who are driving, have safe travels. And if you're at home, relax. Let your feet up. Have a good one.